Ben Shattuck's new book spans 300 years in New England, The History of Sound, stories that examine the unexpected ways the past returns to us and how love and loss are entwined and transformed over generations. Ben Shattuck, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So 12 stories that span three centuries that have these interweaving narratives. Where did this idea come from?
Right. It was a lot to keep track of.
Yeah.
in part, it's just my general view of history that when we look at history, what we're really doing is it's almost like a duet. There's a call and response. There's a people in the present that are experiencing present day, that are experiencing the land, the people around them, relationships around them. And then in history, it's as if you're peering back and trying to trying to listen to a story of the past, but there's always some sort of, as I say, some call and response. And that sometimes when you peer into the past, you can be changed by what you find out. That particularly is the case if you, for a lot of people, I think, if you, you know, you think you have a certain idea of what your family's like, and then all of a sudden you find something in an attic, an old journal or whatever it is. And all of a sudden your conception of who you are, who your family is, it can change in an instant. Additionally, I think we have these large scale cultural conversations about how we view the past and how it's different, and who once was a hero is maybe a villain, or who once was a villain was maybe a hero. And those conversations, that duet of the present and the past, are always happening and always changing over time. And I guess the one last thing I'll say is that I've always written historical fiction. It's just the place that I feel most comfortable. As I said to a friend, when I started writing fiction, I would try to write a story in present day, and then by page two, somebody would pick up a lantern and walk to their horse. So, well, I guess it's just the type of writer I am. You know, growing up on the coast of Massachusetts, it's just my natural sensibilities. I feel very comfortable in the 18th to 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century New England, you know. That's the world I grew up in. So when I started writing historical fiction, historical fiction just seemed the obvious place to start. And then that idea about the conversation between the past and the present took hold. And so it's a combination of those two ideas.
And you're making me think of that. Like so many places in New England, it's like you walk into some of these old buildings and it's like you almost can feel the presence of the past, right? Or you know there's a story. You walk through, you know, down Main Street in Nantucket, past downtown, but the old houses, and you go, you know, it's just fertile ground for so much, right?
So yeah, you don't even, sorry.
No, and each has a companion story, which contains a revelation about a previous paired story. What was that writing process like for this book? Something like you're saying, a lot to keep track of. You know, did you know, okay, I've got this little piece in the story and I'm going to make it in another piece down here, or did it just evolve? How did that come about?
Well, I think for anybody who's written fiction for a while, and I just turned 40 this year, you know, I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop 10 years ago, you know, and this is my first story collection coming out. I think for anybody who writes fiction, you know that a story starts to really become alive when it feels like it begins before page one and ends after the last page, that you've really tapped into a whole world, a whole life, a whole suite of relationships around this person. And when you do that, it's almost as if you are building a living organism. I really think of stories as living organisms. And a story that's complete and a story that's good and a story that I would publish. It's not just a stack of scenes and tracking people moving through spaces. It's as if you've built an instrument that you can play a thousand ways. And so when that happens, the connections, the connective tissue between the stories isn't so hard to find, because if you have built a whole life in a believable, but imagined world, those connective tissues that take place far before or after the character appears and disappears from the page are there. You just have to go searching for them. So, for instance, it makes sense to me. Two of the stories don't both take place on the same farm on Cape Cod, separated by 100 and some odd years. And it just made sense to me that it almost was like I had to restrain myself from writing too much about that connective tissue, because it was all there. And as you just said, it's in if a story is a living organism, in our real life filled with living organisms and time passing, you're just reminded of connections. You just have to walk into any forest in Massachusetts and see a stone wall running between the trees to know that was once a farm field. You know, you just have to imagine the world enough to just let those connective tissues be exposed. So I guess in many ways, I mean, people say this about writing or sculpture or a lot of the arts. It's almost like it's less of a process of building and trying to keep track of those connections, and more just excavating and reducing the noise to find those connecting
One of the things I
parts.
love about is, and you're talking about this, it's not predictable, right? We don't know what's going to happen, which is what I loved about these stories. And I was going to start with the first story, but since you mentioned the two stories on Nantucket, this was the first story. Somebody cleaning out grandma's old house and finds this interesting artifact, which leads him to meet this woman who has a painting, and it's the painting that shows up in a later story. And the story is not really about the painting. And the painting shows up in a later story, which is actually earlier in time, because this brings us to who painted the painting. Again, that's not what the story is about, though. But it's really interesting. And I think it took me a while to get some of these connections because the stories are, as you say, they're so, I don't know, so engaging and it gets you so involved. It's like you're there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I feel like the connection has to not be too obvious,
Right.
you know, that because that's the way that life, that's the way that life works. That's the way, you know, it is a true fact that somebody might run away from home in the 1890s, which will lead you to meet your husband in 2010. You know, you can track these strange, I mean, just think of anybody who you as your spouse, like the 1,000 things that needed to happen to meet somebody you spend the rest of your life with. And if you just expand that into a larger historical perspective, then you can start to see, oh my gosh, the way that life works is within these minute but very real connections that almost exist, like, as I said, like organisms through people's lives. And yeah, I think that one of the fun, really fun parts of writing this book was that not just finding those plot point connections or those character connections. You know, you might, if you read it a few times, you might find even more connections. You know, I hit a lot of Easter eggs in the book that you might not come across right away. But you know, somebody will be related to somebody else that might not be very obvious. Somebody's living in the house that was a much smaller house that had been added upon over the centuries. So it's fun to find all those things, but also that there are thematic links. For instance, in one of the stories that takes place on Cape Cod, a teenage girl runs away from home, and it's about what she leaves behind. Much later in the collection, there is a story about parents trying to find their son who's run away that takes place on the same farm much later on in time. So there's thematic connections that happen too. And the same thing with those two stories you just mentioned, you know, on Nantucket, a painting is found. So there's a little, it's almost like a little, the plot connections are almost like little winks and nods that something's connected here, but it's not just the painting. It's what happens, different themes in people's lives and different emotions.
And emotions, you go through a whole gamut of emotions with these stories. And the first story is a journey of two men who meet around a piano bar. This story just really took me in. I mean, this is a great story. Tell us a little bit, without giving too much away, tell us a little bit about this story.
The story is called The History of Sound. I love it too. I named my collection after
And I
it.
have to say, I didn't. I'm like, why is this book called The History of Sound? Then once I read this, I went, oh, that's why.
Yeah, the history of people have asked about that before, and as one will find out, I don't think it's giving away, but as one will find out in the book, the history of sound is a reference to trying to recover a history that's gone. Sound, you can't hold sound down. And the story is about two young men 100 years ago traveling through Maine collecting folk songs on wax cylinders. That story really came about. There's two factors. One, the world that I grew up in, as I said, I grew up in rural coastal Massachusetts. I went to contra dances and heard fiddle players before I ever went to a school dance. The biggest event of our summers was when everybody was gathering the hay in the fields. It just was that world of old time music, something I loved, and I eventually started to play. I played banjo for a while, and I just loved old time music. There's that, and then also it's a investigation into Edison's wax cylinders. I read years ago this fact that the wax cylinder is one of Edison's only inventions that worked from the moment he thought of it to the moment his engineer mocked a cylinder up. It was almost as if he received a transmission from the divine. He thought of this, it ha it, he drew it out, and all of a sudden people could record sound. And he never imagined it for music. He thought it would be for people recording messages, last, final will and testament. They could record a baby, a teenager, a person in middle life and late life, and it could be like a whole artifact capturing the entire life. Those are the two elements went into the story. I don't know how much more I can say
Well,
without
I would just say
giving
it's
it away.
I don't want to give it away, but it's just this really interesting look at this relationship with you. And I just this I want to read just this little bit. It doesn't give away the story, but it does talk about the title. You write, "The first time David spoke his name to me in the pub, David inviting me to his apartment, asking me one late night if he should join the war or not, and me saying yes because I thought that's what he wanted to hear. The history of sound lost daily. I've started to think of Earth as a wax cylinder, the sun, the needle laid on Earth and drawing out the day's music, the sound of people arguing, cooking, laughing, singing, moaning, crying, flirting, and behind that, a silent sweep of millions of sleeping people washing across the Earth like static." I love that.
Thank you.
But their relationship is again filled with these twists and turns that you don't expect, and it's a really it's that one's an emotional ride. And it was you that particular story's been adapted into a screenplay, right?
Yeah, that's right. It finished filming. It filmed in the Northeast and then Rome and England. It's with Josh O'Connor, Paul Mescal, and Chris Cooper, who lives in Massachusetts. And that was a nearly hallucinatory experience to see, to walk on a set. And I wrote the screenplay for it, so I knew all the scenes and what would happen. But to walk on a movie set from a story that I've imagined is a really bizarre experience. As I've said before, creative writing, fiction writing, the when I do it, and I think when a lot of writers engage their imagination, the line between a thought or a memory or a dream and a scene in fiction writing is very, very, very thin. So when I walked on the set of The History of Sound, which is it almost felt like walking to my own dream. The paintings that I described were really there. The color of the walls is really there. The two characters were standing beside a piano in a world that I'd only imagined in my mind, speaking the lines that I invented. It's so bizarre. I'll remember that day, the first day on set for the rest of my life.
One of the interesting things I find about historical fiction is, I mean, you've got to get the basic history right, but the stuff that gets weaved in, sometimes you go, wait a minute, where is the fact and where is the fiction here? You blur the two, right? So I sometimes find myself looking up, going, did that really happen? Which is kind of the beauty of it, right?
I love that. And that happens in our life all the time. I mean, something that we, in present day, if somebody tried to look back into your life and figure out who you were, well, they might be able to if you, they had your password, read your emails. They might, I mean, you as you, people would be able to understand who you are specifically, but for, you know, the person who's not recording every day, it'd be hard to figure out who people are. And so there's so many, there's so many lies and half-truths and deceptions that take place in our, and trying to, you know, as you build a personality for the public, a personality for your private life, a personality for yourself, it's hard to figure out what is real and what's not real within people. So that idea, I think if you write historical fiction anyway, it's there's a lot of fantasy like elements that take place there, and I just leaned into that. So if you more Easter eggs in the book, there are things, there are facts, there are elements of the book that seem very dull, ordinary facts that are invented, and then there are elements in the book that seem way too wild for real life, and they are verifiable historical facts. And so I toggle between the two.
We're talking with Ben Shattuck. His new book is The History of Sound, and we'll have more after a quick break.
I'm Nina Murray from Nantucket. One of the mysteries about Nantucket history that I've not solved is the question of where you throw your pennies when you're leaving the island. Everyone knows that when you throw the penny and hit the right spot, you're going to have good luck and you're going to come back to the island. Now, in the olden days, in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, we always threw our pennies at the bell buoy at the end of the jetties. We even thought that the captain of the Nauchon came deliberately closer to the buoy to give us a better chance of hitting it. But now everyone throws their pennies at Brant Point. Why? Who changed the tradition? Was it a thought to please the tourist with its simplicity? I've always wondered. You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
A service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Ben Shattuck about his book, The History of Sound. Each of the short stories could stand alone, but it's so interesting as we're talking about how you one story completes a part of its paired story. Where did you know, as you're coming, each of these stories, I say, could stand alone, this idea of pairing stories, did you set out with that idea when you started writing the book, or did that come to you as the stories unfolded?
I'm trying to think of the first time that happened. I had that intuition that there was a natural duet happening between the past and the present. And in part, almost like a fractal, the title story and the first story is that model. There's the story that takes place in the past, and then suddenly an artifact arrives at his doorstep much later in life that shoots him back to the past to understand an element. There's almost a surprise at the end, and he understands an element of his past that he didn't understand before. I think that came only through, I didn't have a master outline. I didn't have a plan. I just started writing through the stories and couldn't help but think about what would happen before or after. And growing up, you know, I live in my great grandfather's house by the sea in South Dartmouth, and it's hard not to think about his life, about my grandmother's life. And when you write, I think, a good piece of historical fiction, the lights are turned on to all those connections in the present and the past. I will say that I started with the past, and figuring out where I would place the stories, which story would take place, what would in the book would take place where, if you, because the mysteries are different depending on which story you read first. The reader understands something significant about the other. One very, very clear story that takes place in the present that is in direct conversation with the past, is a introduction to a fake historical text called Introduction. And I wrote that years ago, and I had been reading so many historical nonfiction books, and I just was fascinated with how authors introduced their text, they always tried to maybe link it to something personal, link it to their interests. And so in that, I just knew there would be a duet, a double story, the story that the author thinks he's writing about and the story that actually happened. Mm.
The characters stay with you long after you put this book down. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about character development. I think that's hard to do. I mean, you know, you have you write a book that's one story and, you know, you kind of get involved. But these are 12 stories and each of them, you remember these characters. I think that's really difficult to do. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you develop your characters.
Oh, my gosh. It is so hard.
It is hard, yeah.
I could answer that question easily. I'd write a book about fiction writing. I mean, in part, I think every fiction writer will say you pull from real life experience. And one of the things that this just goes back to the question of my tendencies to write historical fiction, is I think the standard way to write historical fiction is you find a character who you're interested about from the past, say like a Mayflower passenger, and then you build out the facts of his or her life to understand what life was like back then, crossing the Atlantic. What I do in this book is a little different. I guess I could call it auto-historical fiction. I take relationships from my life around me and I just plop them into the past and see how they fizzle. So for instance, the history of sound it's a story that takes place 100 years ago, but it really came together when I started to write about my feelings from a very, very difficult breakup in my life. I put specific conversations from relationships around me in present day into the past. I discussed my feelings about, discussed in quotes, my boarding school and what I saw in boys' dorms in boarding school in a story about loggers from the early 1900s up in Maine who are caught in a blizzard in a logging camp, and how that very specific sort of teenage boy cruelty can exist and has existed over, you know, centuries and centuries and centuries. So I think to answer your question in terms of character believability, I'm not trying to invent too much. I'm just trying to observe the most, I'm trying to put in the most real
believable. Yeah. Believable.
Yeah. Believable. Yeah. It's a really hard thing. As I just said, I wrote the screenplay for The History of Sound, the movie. And the thing about screenplays, in many ways, it's so much easier because all you have is a brief note on the setting and dialogue. That's it. But with fiction writing, you have to keep track of the quality of the prose and the register of the prose, dialogue, interiority, how characters are developing. There's just a million things to keep track of as you're writing a story. And I think the only way to do that is you write one draft, another draft, another draft. And then the story starts to, and the characters start to speak back to you, and you can almost write without thinking too much about it.
I have to say, hearing that you say that the logging camp was based a little on your experience of boarding school makes so much sense now to me. Really, you know, as you say, the cruelty of some boys. I also want to talk about just briefly a couple of the stories. The Auk and Radiolab. I went, is this a real episode of Radiolab?
I've succeeded.
You have, because I was like, I don't remember that. What made you think of that?
That was so fun to write. Well, you know, I graduated from Cornell and I spent a lot of time at the Cornell Lab for Ornithology. And actually, I started writing short stories because after college, like every 20-something-year-old, I had no idea what to do. And I started taking jobs at research stations, bird research stations, across, you know, the Gulf of Maine. And I had been in the Carmel Valley at Berkeley's research station, catching banding and monitoring Western bluebirds. And in the evenings, there was nothing to do in these remote but beautiful stations. So I started writing short stories, and that's how the writing all started. But the auk, who wouldn't be enchanted by the great auk if you have heard the story? Enchanted in sometimes the saddest ways, you know, this majestic bird that is just totally wiped from the earth. So I wrote that story first, and in some ways, the history of sound, the collection, is a celebration of the short story as a medium. You know, I just wanted to push all the boundaries of what it meant to be writing a story. And if you live in the 21st century, podcasts are probably a big part of your life. And they're some of my favorite stories come from podcasts, come from episodes from This American Life or from Radiolab. And I knew Radiolab really well because I listened to it all the time. And also, when I was living in Brooklyn years ago, my housemates were Radiolab producers.
Okay, that's why you got it spot on.
I really know what it sounds like. I mean, not that they would play it at home, but I felt like it gave me permission to write a Radiolab transcript.
That was fun.
Yeah, and I also feel like with Radiolab or with podcasts, there is a tension there that's not always named, which is a little bit of doubt about the reporting that's happening. There's a story building, but you know, we don't really know what's going on. This isn't like years long in-depth investigative reporting. Sometimes it's a look into the past and sort of a really beautifully illuminated question about what might have happened, but there's room in there for doubt. Mm-hmm. And I like to play with that room for doubt.
Yeah. All right. Another story, The Children of New Eden. Now, here's a story that stayed with me in an uncomfortable way. As I say, we run the gamut of emotions through these stories. And that one, I was like, oh, I was not expecting to walk away from that uncomfortable. Did you want that? Is that what you were looking for us to feel all this whole range of emotions with these stories?
Yeah. I think one of the really important and impactful things one can do when they're writing about the past is write about experiences that aren't over the top. You know, if you're going to write about the past, I'd rather not write about, I don't know, a mass murderer in the 1800s. You know, it just seems too easy. You write about small experiences that one might have through a day. I mean, one of the stories in the past, it takes place in Nantucket, and the entire story is somebody visiting for one night, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Nothing really happens. All to say, as a preamble, that the Children of New Eden is one of those stories where there's a little bit spicier content. I don't know. It's I leaned into it a little bit, and absolutely, I wanted to make people feel uncomfortable and uncomfortable about what they think was happening in the 16, 1700s. All across the colonies. It's easy to just point to the Salem witch trials or to any really discussed event of the 17th century. But can you imagine in a time when there's so little communication, so little understanding of the natural world, and just a real steadfast belief in the afterlife, in the way the world works, what weird little pockets of communities were existing. And so I just loved exploring that. And yeah, I'm glad it made you feel uncomfortable. That one, I will say, also is one of those stories that there's stories within stories within the stories in The Children of New Eden. And one of those stories was, you know, years ago, listening to a friend's experience. I won't get too far into that, but yeah, listening to a friend's experience and just knowing that how, I hope it's not giving too much away, but how cults exist, mm-hmm. how people feel trapped, how that's existed forever. It's just been called something else.
Yeah.
Between 1600, 1700, 1800.
I'm trying to remember which story this was, where we meet the author of the painting, Will. Which story was that?
Edwin Chase of Nantucket.
Okay, Edwin Chase. That story, this is another one that I love. There's mysteries that are solved, also mysteries created. Like in this story, when we meet Will, and we have this, what was the relationship between his neighbor who he's come to visit after all these years, right? We don't know. It's a thing that who is this coming down our walk? Alina, we're out here in the middle of nowhere, and it's somebody that Laurel knows well, but how well?
Yeah.
We don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you're writing this, there's a thousand questions to answer, but one of those is whose perspective are you going to tell this story from? If
right.
I was telling that story from Laurel's perspective, you'd know exactly who he was and why they might have had a missed, you know, love or what.
Or
you would have known exactly what the experience is. And I have, you know, I have my ideas, and I think that story took a while to fully form. And I did switch around the characters, who was telling the story and why not. But I think there's a reason. I think there's a real tension, a real narrative tension when you don't know exactly what the relationship is, because that's what happens in real life. Mm-hmm. You know, you see somebody acting a little strangely about somebody who comes to the house or talking on the phone, or they maybe have a conversation, they seem a little disturbed. And that is a narrative tension in itself.
Yeah. I can see there's going to be a whole lot of book clubs choosing this book just because of all of these questions and all these Easter eggs and who can find what. It's going to be, I think, a lot of conversation for sure. I'm going to have to go back and reread now that you said I probably missed some of these Easter eggs. I'm sure I missed some of them when I was reading it.
Who knows? Yeah, like, well, you know, that we find out what happens to Will just in a phrase mm-hmm. in the story, Silver Clip, after. But,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
we don't know what happens.
We don't know. Yeah. We're talking with Ben Shattuck. His new book, It's the History of Sound, and we'll have more after a quick break.
We grew everything. The only thing we had delivered was milk and ice. And once in a while, somebody come by with fish. But basically, we fed ourselves. We had a huge garden, and so did all our neighbors. Everybody grew what they needed, raised chickens.
From Menempsha, 91-year-old Jane Slater.
And I had to kill the chickens. I didn't like that too much, but I didn't like the chickens, so it was easy.
You're listening to WCAI, local public radio for the Cape, Coast, and Islands.
Listening to The Point, we're talking with Ben Shattuck about his book, The History of Sound. All right, so in addition to your writing, you also paint.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
so,
it's like a family business.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, in fact, I have your dad's book behind me over here. Your dad also paints. Yeah, it's like, I guess it's in your blood, right? So what is that like for you? Is there one, you know, some people... You know, the writing process, you got to sit down, and it's very different than you going in and, you know, painting. Tell me about those two different hats, and do you prefer one over the other, or are they equal?
The relationship between writing and painting exists now as exactly as it did when I was in middle school or elementary school. Going to art class is so fun. Going to English class is so hard. That's exactly how it feels. You know, I don't think there'll ever be a time when I'm not excited to be painting. It's such a joyful act. And the type of painting I do, representational oil painting, it came, it's quote unquote in the blood. I have a Aaron Draper Shattuck painting. You know, he's a Hudson River School painter. There have been painters in my family since the 1800s. But I think part of that is that I just grew up on the floor of my dad's studio. I knew what negative space was. I knew how you could see the sky through the trees. And that's what made the shape of, you know, the leaves and everything. I knew what perspective was just by looking at his paintings. I grew up in a studio workshop. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to painting, it just came very naturally, I think.
So what inspires you then? Where do you get your inspiration for painting?
For painting? Something just strikes me. I mean, I think that's when I want to paint something, the only reason I'm painting it, and I include this in the story, The Silver Clip, the story's about a painter. And there's a long passage in which to himself he's describing why he wants to make a painting. I think the idea behind the best paintings, think of a Monet, think of the lily pads, is that you can't put words to it. There's mm-hmm. there's just something about the visual impact that hits an abstract emotional chord that is hard to name. So when I feel that, I don't know, when I wake up in the morning and I walk out with coffee and maybe there's maybe my wife has put some flowers in a little vase and the light is passing through and it's casting some shadow. What is that? I don't know what that is, but I feel moved by it. And so I think I apply the paintbrush to it. I will also say that I find writing way more difficult. I find fiction writing the hardest of anything, of any type of writing, and painting easier in a way that it's just enjoyable. But the rewards of the difficulty in fiction writing are so great, because when I'm in my studio, which is my dad's old painting studio, which is a little old woodshed by the sea, and there's no internet, and I don't bring my phone down, and it's quiet and it's dark, and I'm running through a scene and I almost don't have to think of anything because the character it's like a transmission. The character's just moving through and I'm putting it down. The rewards of that, it's like a high. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of the best experiences in life, I think. And it takes a while to drill down to that. But I never experienced something like that in painting. Painting is much more superficial for me. Yeah.
All right, so as if you don't have enough already, painting, you write screenplays, you're writing books, you're also the owner of the oldest general store in America.
Yes.
And I didn't know, your mom told me this. I did an event with her at the gallery, and she's like, oh yeah, you know, Ben, and you know, general stores, come on, New England and general stores. General stores are like the community centers, right? Everybody goes to the general store. So tell us a little bit about this general store and why you wanted, there's not that many owners, and it's 1793, right, is when it?
Yeah, 1793. Yeah. I mean, it was around when George Washington was alive.
That's amazing.
You know, I was thinking that when I was standing in the general, in the main section where we have, you know, the local grocery section. And I was sitting on my phone trying to, you know, I think reply to an email from an insurance agent about the policy, you know, one of these very busy, busy tasks when you're opening a small business. And the lights were on, I was on my phone, and I thought, what would somebody who was standing in this exact space in 1793 even think I was doing? Before electricity, it's just so strange to exist in the space. And what would somebody where is this space going to exist in 230 some odd years? And the person standing where I'm standing, what will they be, a hologram? Like, what will it even be? And it really bears those questions when you stand in that space. This is the store that my great grandmother shopped at, and it's the store where my brother and I bought Penny Candy. It's the store that I know intimately in all its iterations. And I've always loved it. You know, I lived abroad. I've lived in New Zealand and the Netherlands and California and Norway, Australia. I've lived abroad, and I always wanted to come home to South Coast Massachusetts, and it felt like coming back to the Shire. And I really think the Devall's General Store is like the center of the Shire. It is Facebook in real life. My dad stops there 3 times a day. You can't stop there without saying hi to somebody, without knowing all the people that are there. I think it's doing so well. I think in part because people are thirsting for that community space. Mm-hmm. Churches used to, in New England, used to take up that space, meeting houses. But where do we run into people anymore? The mm-hmm. amount of times I see people walk in for milk and eggs, see somebody sit down, say, why don't we grab a sandwich and talk is incredible. I mean, yeah. I think it's a really important space. And the reason why I bought it is because I'd been living in Amsterdam for 3 years, and I wanted to have, I thought, if I'm going to move back to rural Massachusetts, I want to have a country pub where I can sit and have a beer and talk to a friend.
Yeah. Well, so. And if you'd even just look at, I think more so probably in Northern New England than we would see in Southern New England, but the general store, if you can't find something, where do you go? The general store. You want to know what's happening? The general store, that's where you can get everything you need and find out all the town gossip and what's happening. I mean, there's two things I want to mention about the store that I found really interesting. Do you still have the antique phone booth with a secret phone number?
We have the phone booth, but a hurricane knocked it over and ripped out the phone cord, and we just haven't gotten back to it. But yes, that was it. When we opened, it was a phone booth with a phone inside that if you called a specific number, you could hear my wife reading poems. Mm-hmm. So it was a poetry booth, it was a secret poetry booth, but it also was a working, you know, landline.
Yeah.
And it was so fun to see millennials and anybody older have their kids go into the phone booth and try to figure out how to use the phone because they've never used landline.
Yeah.
And there'd be so many pictures of kids standing looking completely confused with the phone. Yeah.
That was the first thing I thought of when I read that. I thought, how many young people go and go, what the heck is that? Right.
Exactly.
All right. And then the other thing I thought was interesting is the book collection. You have a little bit, it's part bookstore there as well, but it isn't necessarily like the latest books. It's really books that you want to read. Is that how you choose the books? How do you choose what you're carrying?
I mean, maybe at one point it's a full-fledged bookstore now.
Yeah.
That, we have a book club. We have authors reading. A full new fiction section, new nonfiction. Yeah. It's a fully running bookstore. And the, amazing thing is that anybody who runs an independent bookstore will also tell you, bookstores are doing so well these days. I think that maybe there's like a anti-Amazon snap or something. People, when they walk into a bookstore, they just want to buy a book. It's really incredible. And it's one of the like more successful parts of the business. It's amazing.
That doesn't surprise me. I think that, you know, when you walk into a bookstore, you aren't always going in there thinking, I'm looking for this particular book, right? You're going in there going, what might I find browsing these shelves? And in the independent bookstores, the booksellers know a lot about books. And, you know, you can go up and say, hey, I'm looking for a book for my, you know, 12-year-old niece who's into such and such. And they'll find you the perfect book. That's hard to do online when you don't know what you're looking for, right? So I think that's part of the magic and beauty of bookstores. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And we curate books. You curate the books that somebody might walk into a section of, I don't know, new and notable books. They might see the book they thought they wanted and then see a book right beside it that they didn't necessarily expect to find.
All right. So, and you're also the director and founder of the Cuttyhunk Island Writers Residency. Tell us more about that. Is that something you're doing just in the summer?
That started in 2016. That happens now once a year in September.
Oh, September.
Cuttyhunk is the island right across from our home, and I always loved it. And after I graduated from Iowa, I'd done a bunch of residencies and thought that Cuddy Hunk would be a beautiful place for something like that. And there are the Cuddy Hunk functions for two reasons. One, it's in a beautiful location in the Avalon Inn, which is this gorgeous 100-year-old inn. Most of the rooms have clawfoot bathtubs and four-post beds, just like stepping back in time. And we have a chef that comes, and all the food is, you know, there's a lot of local seafood, and it's you know, Cuddy Hunk oysters are on the menu, all of that. It's amazing, just experience. And then also I invite really wonderful, often award-winning, successful authors to lead workshops on the island. So we've had, you know, Paul Harding and, but, you know, since 2016, many authors who've come through and lead the workshops there. So it's, yeah, it's been a great experience. The hardest part is, you know, sifting through all the applications. And I hope it'll continue, but.
Yeah. So what's next? Do you have another book idea? And I know this one's just coming out, but have you already started on the next one? Are you taking a break? What's the plan?
I've somehow accidentally found myself in a screenwriting career. So I'm currently under contract to finish an adaptation of somebody else's work. And when I finish that, I'm starting on a novel. It'll be in the shape of the history of sound, in that there'll be conversations between the past and present, but it'll be much tighter with fewer characters that'll create some central force to make it actually a novel and not a short story collection. Yeah. Last year I went to, it starts in Eastern Germany in the 1700s and passes through the Lake District in England and goes up to upstate New York. So there's it's been really fun to do, to be in the research stage. And it's going to be much harder to just sit down with a stack of notes and start typing away. But I'll start that this fall.
I would think, being the history buff that you are, that would be the most fun, the research, right? Because we said you have to have some of the history, right? And to write about a place, you have to maybe have been there, even though you're there in a different time, right?
Yeah, I mean, in part, you want to go there to verify facts or to verify landscape, verify what, you know, what the church bells sound like, or where the cobblestone squares are, or what kind of birds are flying overhead at sunset, or whatever, you know, whatever those facts are of world making. But then something always happens when you go to a place or you start researching, is you stumble upon like an unexpected treasure, a new narrative treat. And, you know, when I was up in the Lake District researching for this book, I came across this, it was for something not related to this, but I came across a history of people disappearing into the mountains in the Lake District. This is right near where Wordsworth was. And then finding a plaque somewhere, finding out somebody's name, what might have happened to them. And this is just like narrative gold. Mm. I mean, and I would have never found it about this person's life if I hadn't just been there to research what it felt like and what it looked like to walk through these windy, rainy, you know, weather-torn mountains. That's the great part of doing research.
Really enjoyed your book, The History of Sound, Ben Chaddick. Thank you so much. We're going to have a link at our website for more information on the book. Ben, thanks so much for being with us. Joy talking to you. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.